Are you ready to take your business to the next level? Every day there are countless books and articles that are published offering the key on how to make your business a success. It's easy to feel overwhelmed trying to keep up and run your business. That's why Deb Creer created the Business Power Hour. Keep up on the latest trends, best practices, and techniques for how to make your business a success. Let the Business Power Hour do the heavy work for you.
Good morning, good morning. I am Deb Creer, and I am passionate about giving professionals the tools that they need to make themselves and their businesses as successful as possible. And oh my gosh, we are approaching 1,000 programs, and I have never talked to someone who's going to be talking to us about what we're going to be discussing today. So I am so excited about this. It also brings my childhood back. So now that we've really piqued everybody's interest, please join me in welcoming Jeff Cedar to our program today. Welcome, Jeff. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Perfect. We're going to have such a fun discussion, but let me tell people a little bit about you, and then we will jump into this. So Jeff Cedar is the founder of Equine Biometrics and Exercise Physiology, EQB, which helps high net worth individuals and entrepreneurs looking to get into the horse racing business pick and manage young, unraced thoroughbred horses who then may become champions. Jeff has spent millions, including over $7 million of his own money, researching and refining the science of picking a champion racehorse for more than four decades, and he has grown EQB to be one of the U.S.'s leading talent scout buyers for young, unraced thoroughbred horses. They helped one of their clients go from a startup to being the leading U.S. racing stable in just 4 years with a profit. This was even before the client made $50 million from a racehorse they selected that won several world championships and became the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years. Several other clients have also had world champions. Jeff disrupted the horse racing industry by developing a quantitative approach to finding the best racehorses, much of which has now been widely copied. So, oh my gosh, Jeff, so much fun, so much fun. Well, tell us, you know, because I'm sure people are thinking, how the heck did you get into doing this? So tell us a little bit more about how you discovered this as your passion.
Well, I was 27 years old, and I was in a joint program at Harvard in law.
And I didn't mention, you are Harvard educated.
I was in a joint program at Harvard doing the law schools and the business schools at the same time before they had a joint program. Mm-hmm. And I went on a date with ride horses at a rental stable. Okay. And instead of falling in love with the girl, I fell in love with the horse, and I became obsessed, and I started taking lessons, and I was riding, and I ended up buying a horse, and then the story goes from there. Mm-hmm. And so I was too big to be a jockey. I was actually a wrestler, actually qualified for the Olympic trials out of Harvard as a wrestler. Mm-hmm. But I was too big to be a jockey. I didn't have any connections. I didn't have the money to buy racehorses. I didn't know anybody or anything in it. And I thought, how the hell am I going to? But I had to do a thesis combining something about law and business.
Okay.
So it got to be like March of my senior year. And my senior advisor was Archibald Cox. Mm-hmm. Maybe you remember him from the Nixon days, the Midnight Massacre, the special prosecutor, and all that. And his office was like typical at Harvard. It was in the stacks, which are these piles of books and bookcases, and his desk is in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I went to see him, and it's March, and he had to sit down, and he said, well, how's it going on this thesis? And I didn't have a thesis, and I'm looking at the ground. So he figured out what was wrong, and he said, well, what are you interested in? And I looked at the ground again, and I said, horses. And I thought he would throw me out, but he didn't throw me out. And he turned around, and he got a great big book from the shelves behind him, and he took it out and he dropped it on the desk, and the dust went up all over the place. And he said, this is the statute that governs horse racing in Massachusetts. And nobody here has ever looked at it. Why don't you do that, business and law? And so I went to town, and I went to the I went to the archives in the Capitol and I did everything, studied the racetrack finances, and I discovered all. And I really went to town on it, discovered all kinds of interesting and illegal things, among other. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting an A on it. And so I thought, this is how I could go maybe with horses and be outside. And maybe I could do something in racing because, like, mm-hmm. it was a business.
Right.
And I thought, but I didn't know, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, I got all this legal and I was pre-med as mm-hmm. well, undergrad.
Oh, my God.
And I got all this scientific education. Well, mm-hmm. They're doing it the same way they've been doing it for 300 years. Mm-hmm. Eyeball and intuition.
Right.
And in a tiny little clique in Kentucky, in New York, why don't I try to bring this new stuff? This was like 20 years before Moneyball, Billy. Mm-hmm. And if I'd known how hard it would be and how long it would take and how much it would cost, I would have never done it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I decided to do that. And I was working, my first job was at Citicorp, and I was in the new building they built at like 3rd and Lexington, and, mm-hmm. and they had a huge atrium in the bottom, like 3 stories mm-hmm. high was the cafeteria, and all around 3 stories high was a mural of Pennsylvania farmland. Mm-hmm. And I was there one day in my 3-piece suit, and I looked at it all. I said, why am I looking at this? Why aren't I living it? Mm-hmm. And within a week, I quit, and I went, and I rented an apartment building in Pennsylvania, which is, people don't know it, but there's a county in Pennsylvania, Chester County, which has more racehorses than anywhere else in the right. United States. Mm-hmm. And they don't even have signs. They're really old money and mm-hmm. big time stables. Mm-hmm. And they're big into steeplechasing. Mm-hmm. And they run the steeplechase races across their own farms.
Right.
So mm-hmm. it's a really heavy duty racehorse area. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's where I went. And because I was from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And away we went. It was 20 years. And then I got myself onto the brand new Olympic sports medicine training stuff. In 1976, this is how old I am, the Olympics were losing money. And mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the East Germans came back and they were winning everything. This little tiny country, and nobody knew how they were doing it. And they mm-hmm. thought it was like mad scientists in kindergarten. Right,
they had to be cheating. Mm-hmm.
They were cheating. But anyway, nobody knew that yet. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so they formed a committee in the United States, the Olympic Committee, to do sports mm-hmm. medicine. And I was a young lawyer. And I ended up helping them do that, documents and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I learned a tremendous amount. And I found out that the elite athletes, mm-hmm. they had to have data on them. It turned out that elite athletes were as different from normal as normal mm-hmm. is from sick or injured. Mm-hmm. So you had to create new databases right. to know what the hell to do. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's what I'll do in racehorses. Mm-hmm. It turned out that none of the data existed. Not only did none of the data exist, but none of the equipment to get to that existed.
Mm-hmm, right.
They didn't have a heart rate meter that would mm-hmm. work, was accurate on racehorses mm-hmm. when they were racing. They had human heart meters, and they didn't work for a lot of reasons. And they didn't know anything about the gas exchange, mm-hmm. the VO2 and all those things mm-hmm. they knew about human athletes. And they didn't have anything about the heart and the lungs, and they just didn't know, and they were all mm-hmm. guessing. And so I set about, first thing I had to do was try to get the data, and I realized I had to create the equipment. So I got a day job, and I ended mm-hmm. up doing other business stuff. I did up doing mm-hmm. leverage buyouts and making the money and putting it all into the research. Okay. And I was, you know, it just was an obsession. And we did things like, well, we went to the leading cardiologist in veterinary medicine for mm-hmm. horses, and showed us a horse heart in a jar, and he said, look at the size of this, so it's not mm-hmm. going to go mm-hmm. as fast as human hearts, and this and that and the other, blah, blah. So we said, we can't do animal training without a heart rate meter, so we had to invent one that mm-hmm. even though the horses can twitch off a fly all over their body, which is electrical noise that would ruin the EKG signal to the electrodes, and we couldn't shave the hair off because they were somebody else's racehorse. They were,
right.
Mm-hmm. We had to invent electrodes that could get around that, and a heart rate meter that could get around mm-hmm. that. And this was before there were personal computers. I had mm-hmm. a special chip designed by Hitachi mm-hmm. to sort through the electrical noise and find the pattern of an EKG.
Wow.
And it was called an autocorrelation mm-hmm. point. And I had the first accurate, you know, heart rate meter for racehorses. Mm-hmm. And then nobody wanted it, of course. Mm-hmm. We celebrated when somebody stole one at the racetrack.
somebody wanted it, right.
Anyway, and what we discovered, when we're trying to develop this thing, we couldn't get it right. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, we discovered the heart rates were going up to 250 beats a minute on the racetrack. And in their stall, you could walk into the stall, mm-hmm. and some of these really good racehorses, they'd have a resting heart rate of like 28 beats a minute.
Right, right.
And when you walked in, they didn't seem to mm-hmm. turn a hair, and it went to 120, bang, mm-hmm. just like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to these cardiologists, and they, you know, and we tested, and finally said, you know, nothing wrong with the equipment. You guys are wrong. You were guessing, mm-hmm. and this is mm-hmm. data, and this is it.
Right.
And then we were trying to understand that stuff about the rest of the exercise physiology. Mm-hmm. So what they did with humans was they put them on a treadmill, and they put a mask.
Right. We've seen the pictures.
They,
yeah.
They mm-hmm. gather the oxygen and the CO2 mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. So we put the horse in a pool in a sling, and we developed mm-hmm. a mask to put on it. And then we got these spirometers. Now a spirometer mm-hmm. is this giant like water heater, and the mm-hmm. gases go into that. And then afterwards mm-hmm. you take the gas out of that to measure.
Okay.
So we did it, and the thing filled up in like 2 seconds. So we chained two of them together, and that mm-hmm. filled up in like 4 seconds. So we chained three of them together. Mm-hmm. We said, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. We can't get more than like 6 seconds of exercise. So we got a weather balloon, put it down on the ground next mm-hmm. to the pool, and we started filling up the weather balloon so we could mm-hmm. get all the gases from like, you know, a 10-minute workout or five.
Right, right.
And
what did the horses think about this?
Well, you know, I don't know. But what we thought about it, we looked at each other and said, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
With something wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
And what was wrong was the horses don't, the lungs were not just for oxygenating their blood in the horses, they're panting. Mm-hmm. They're thermoregulation, they're cooling themselves.
Oh, okay.
Like a dog,
okay.
Panting.
Like a dog.
So they, mm-hmm. Yeah. So they've got a lung capacity that's so vastly beyond mm-hmm. what they need to get the oxygen they need that right. it's ridiculous mm-hmm. to try and work on them, mm-hmm. like interval training, to give them an additional oxygen capacity. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. It just creates dullness and lamenesses.
Right. They don't need that.
They don't need it. Evolution gave it to them. When mm-hmm. the wolves appear, they could bang, take off mm-hmm. and run a mile.
Right. Especially if you're a thoroughbred.
Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond that. They discovered that one of the ways the Russians and the East Germans were cheating was they were putting aside, take out blood and then spin out
right.
the red blood
they did blood packing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Blood doping mm-hmm. before the race.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that the racehorses have these huge spleens with a mm-hmm. wonder why. And then they contract them right before they get excited, like a race. And they pump like almost 50%, 60% more red blood cells into their system. So just like the Russian cheaters, they're mm-hmm. blood doping themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm. But they did it naturally.
Naturally, because evolution gave it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we trying to develop their fitness?
Mm-hmm.
They've evolved to run a mile like that, starting like that. That's who they are. What we have to do is make them want to do it mm-hmm. and be safe and not lame right. and not hurt. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. there's no free agents. Nobody asks mm-hmm. them, do you want to do this?
Right. Yeah. It's just, you get to do this. Mm-hmm.
And when I was younger and I was, literally working out horses, racehorses mm-hmm. in the morning, I could ride. I did ride. I jumped 6-foot fences and walls
mm-hmm.
with a flask of bourbon right. on my hip. I went hunting in
the steeplechasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the culture I was in mm-hmm. Southeastern PA. Anyway, we would go out in the morning in sets of 5 or 6 horses to exercise mm-hmm. the horses on these long turf gallops all mm-hmm. through the woods and everything. And it's a whole different than the racetrack mm-hmm. there. And what I learned was some of the horses, boy, you had to keep kicking and working to get them to keep mm-hmm. up. And other horses, it was worth your life that they didn't run off with you.
Right.
They had to be up front.
You and hung on. Mm-hmm.
And you just, and so you, I thought, my God, you know, so much of this is how much is the great.
Right. What is their mentality?
Mm-hmm. We're great. Psychiatrist working with Billy Turner when he had Seattle Slough, one of mm-hmm. the classic best horses ever and a triple crown winner.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a horse psychologist. I learned from him about getting horses so they wanted to run. And right about that, I went to Hialeah, which then was a great racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in Miami, and it was just a classic place with
mm-hmm.
velvet couches in the grandstand.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this race, and it was a cheap race. And normally at the end of the race, the horses are stretched out all the way from the back all the way to the finish mm-hmm. in a big at the end.
Right.
And in this race, a dog, a collie, gets out on the track and starts chasing him up the track.
Oh, no.
And they all go together in this tight little pack, and they mm-hmm. finish. You could have thrown a blanket over all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my God, that's what happens when they all are trying.
Mm-hmm.
I never forgot it. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's easier to try if you've got all the advantages.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so we also created the first ultrasound machine that was portable with an Apple IIc mm-hmm. and some black box stuff from defense contractors. So you could go into the stall and measure their heart.
Mm-hmm.
The size, people were doing it with EKGs.
Right.
With, trying to, it was supposed to be related to the mass of the heart from a guy in Australia invented it. But the problem with that was when I went into the, this is what I figured out. I watched them do it and I said, this is the, I said, oh my God. They have this little machine, which is tape, and the tape's running and the needle's going. And then it would make, catch out the EKG.
With people.
And then they would measure between this peaks to tell you, and it related to the mass of the heart. And I said, that's great, except for one problem. I've done a lot of work in these barns now with ultrasound. Always, I know the voltage goes up and down and up and on. And it, your little motor running your little tape is speeding up and slowing down. And you're measuring the distance between the peaks based on that. I said, why don't we do it directly with ultrasound? They said, well, there's no way to do that. You have to go to $1 million machine in the middle. It's huge and it's at this vet hospital. So I said, well, let's invent one. So we did. And so I got the guys together and we worked from an Apple IIc. And again, we did all this defense contractor black box stuff, and we got one, the first one you could go in the stall, you could measure the heart with ultrasound, and then we were having trouble making it so it was get the same result every time, and we realized that the protocol for doing that exam was very, very difficult and wasn't reproducible in a lot of cases. So we changed it. We went the other side of the horse. We found different landmarks in the physiology of the heart, and today our machine and that protocol is what everybody uses. And so, and then we began, now we have like 50,000 horses, real race horses in the database for that. And it turns out every really good horse has a heart that's like 50% bigger than the average and stronger and better muscle.
Right.
It's not enough. There's plenty of horses with big, strong hearts that don't run on it faster than a fat lady on roller skates, but they got to have it. It's like squares and rectangles, you know. The heart's not enough, but you aren't going to make it without it. Otherwise, it's a weak link in the chain. And they also, going with the heart, they would have these big spleens and they would have these big lungs. And it all came together in a package, and all the really good horses.
And then mental.
Well, mental was a different thing. We had to measure differently, but that's another story.
Right.
Anyway, so, but it's a whole lot easier to run when you're safe. We did it on the gate. I started using 500 pictures per second on the gate of these horses, and I would go to the auctions and then run the film, the NFL films in Miami overnight, and then you digitize it, run it through projectors on the wall. And I had a whole hotel room next to the racetrack, and I was on cables all up and down the halls of the hotel to connect everything, and going back on telephone lines to the main computer textile company in Philadelphia. And we were looking at the gates of these horses, and they're like fingerprints, and they're good horses. They're safer. They're more efficient. And if they're safer and they're more efficient in their gait, the gait's like a fingerprint.
Right.
They have to get up and keep up with the herd when they're born in like 20 minutes or the wolves would eat them. So they don't learn to walk.
Right. They have to walk very fast.
They have it. It's imprinted in them, and they're all different. And there's some of them are efficient and safe, and some most of them aren't. And so we got so we could identify that. Of course, it took years and years of who did well and who didn't do well and all that stuff. And big statistical packages and using professors of statistics at major universities and engineers from MIT and doctors from Harvard and all that, paying through the nose for everything and collecting bones of horses that broke down and studying those. So anyway, we ended up with a protocol, a methodology for picking race horses on all these different variables, their gait, their heart, and their conformation and all kinds of other, and plus kind of getting to know something about their attitudes. One of the champions we bought, we went to the yearling to look at her, and when the yearlings, and they were like, I don't know, at a big farm, there were 20, 30 yearlings in the farm. And we were there at feeding time. So they were all coming to the gate to come in and have dinner, and they're all crowded at the gate. And all of a sudden the Red Sea parts and it's this filly comes striding through. And I thought, that's a dominant. I want that one. If she passes the other test, and she didn't, she became a champion and worth millions of dollars. And another one was a horse named Club Fighter. Her name was Madcap Escapade. Another one was named Club Fighter. We went, and all the yearlings in the field had short tails because they were biting each other's tails. And one of them, one of them, nobody touched his tail. And said, he passed the test.
Right. And so that attitude of I'm in charge, kind of.
Yeah. Dominance. Conrad Lorenz.
Right. Right. Which happens with animals. I mean, it just has to. You have the alpha, and you might have a couple alphas, but then you have everybody else.
In some of these races, I'm convinced the horses communicate the starting gate, who's winning. And that's that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My turn. Right.
And don't mess with me or I'll kick your lights out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I started out in a bank. the JD MBA from Harvard, and I failed, and I never regretted it. I live on a farm. There are baby horses in the spring. My office is often at the racetrack. It's exciting. The social stuff is fun. You know, $2 on a horse and the race becomes interesting. It was a grand scientific puzzle. I was a disruptor, though. The guys are all about pedigree and tradition.
And looking at it. I mean, that was it. You know, they would just look and know.
And their eyeball intuition. And I said, they'd say, I can see all that. And I was thinking, bullshit. Because you're buying horses. I see at the auctions, $300,000, $500,000.
Right.
You couldn't give it to me because I know with my camera and 500 frames a second and digitizing, this horse is not going to. He's going to get hurt. He puts out, he's fast, but he can't carry the speed because he's so inefficient the way
he does.
So anyway, I knew they were full of shit. So that didn't, and I was arrogant. It didn't make me any friends. So I needed a client, right? How did I get started? So I was going years and years of this, spending all this money. Everybody thought I was a jerk.
Right, and you're not making any money.
I was making fun of us. I finally decided I'm going to publish. So a lot of my so I had to fight the battle because I wasn't a veteran engineer, although I had all these degrees. And I ended up publishing data in the major veterinary journals, when referee, where you had to get through the experts in the field, which was tough. And one of the first things I did was show them that everything in the textbooks about the gator racehorses was wrong. They were wrong. It was different at that speed. So obviously they said, well, what do you know about quadruped locomotion? So I published, here it is, 10,000 horses, or 12,000 horses over 10 years, and here's their blah, 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 blah. And it was a good panel. It got through referee, and all of a sudden they weren't laughing, but they weren't hiring me. So I went to the guy in Kentucky who was one of the biggest stables. He was a champion breeder. He was a champion stable. And I made my pitch. And he said, okay, you have like 200 horses. He said, and it was Ken Rams, who, by the way, was a real entrepreneur. His story is great. And a real gentleman. A lot of people in horse racing are not so nice. Some of them are
It's so spoiled. Competitive. That you
It's
know,
so it's, competitive. Some of them are very nice. Some of them are just rich spoiled. But he was a gentleman. And so I went to him and he said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to come to my farm, spend a week, make one recommendation. I said, no, let me tell you, you can't do it with one horse. You know, you
have
to blah, blah, blah. And he says, no, make one recommendation. So I said, okay, you know, he's making the rules. Golden rule. The gold makes the rules, right?
Right. Owns the gold makes the rules.
So I went there, and at the end of it, I said, in about a month, it's the Belmont Stakes, one of the most prestigious, most valuable stakes in the horse racing world. If a horse wins it, he's a stallion, he's made for life. You have a new stallion called Caddy Ansys you want to make. You have a colt by him, who's a three-year-old who would be eligible. Because it's only three-year-olds,
yep.
And it hasn't won a race yet. I think it was three or four races. I hadn't done squat. It was called a maiden. And I said, so he's not worth anything. If he were to do well in the Belmont Stakes, in the first crop of your new stuff, not only would he be worth it, but your stallion would all of a sudden...
Right, his value would go...
From nothing to something. And so he burst out laughing. He said, it's a maiden. You know, usually you enter the very best young horses in the Belmont Stakes in the world, right? So I said, no. He said, well, why? I said, well, because when I was in the Olympic sports team, they were doing this with swimmers. They found out that in repetitive muscles, repetitive motions, there's a fatigue rate. And the fatigue rate follows a logarithmic curve, and it's specific to the specific muscle and the specific athlete. So you can kind of predict on how they slow down, what their time will be for much longer distance swimming. And I've been doing it with the horses. And I said, and you know, or maybe you don't know, that in almost all of these races, when it looks like a horse is passing everybody and he's speeding up at the end, all he's doing is slowing down less than everybody else. They're all slowing down in the dark.
Right, because they get tired.
Because they get tired and they run like hell. So I said, this horse is slow, but he doesn't slow down. And if you extrapolate his
So he keeps curve, the same consistent
yeah,
pace.
He just keeps going. So this horse can run like 12 seconds per long all day long. And if the longest race there is that none of these horses have ever run is the Belmont Stakes, mile and a half. They aren't going to be laughing at the end of a mile and a half. So we enter them. And the night before the race, the daily racing room is going through all the stuff about this horse and maybe that horse and the odds and blah, blah, blah.
Right. And he's at the bottom.
And then they said, and then there's the jokers and the idiots, and they never apologize. So then we get there, and the trainers telling everybody, you know, I know this is silly, and they're making me do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm there. And mm-hmm. so then the race starts, and the horse mm-hmm. is dead last, and he's trailing the field, and I'm ready to go under the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
About halfway through the race, he starts to pick up horse.
Right, because he's still going the same
and they're starting
pace.
To slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And then about getting ahead of the stretch, he's starting to come on strong. Mm-hmm. And up the stretch, he's passing everybody. And by the end, if there was another three strides, he might have won. He's third in the Belmont Stakes.
Wow.
It's a big deal.
He's in the money.
And so in the money, and first, second, third, he's obviously competitive with the best mm-hmm. horses in the world at that mm-hmm. distance. And to prove it wasn't a fluke, a little while later in the Louisiana Super Derby, which was a million-dollar race, he did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I got hired. And then I worked with him. And after that, I got him like, promptly, he always wanted to win the Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. They never had. He hadn't been in it very long.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately got him like three or four horses, year after year, at low odds in the Kentucky Derby.
Mm-hmm.
Although I never won it for him. I was second twice, and I won it for another client, but I didn't mm-hmm. win it for him. Maybe someday we will.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, so then people started to take notice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when a guy from Egypt who wanted to get into the game, one of the smartest guys I ever met, very, very passionate, a guy mm-hmm. named Ahmed Zayat.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in, he came to me, and he was like in his first year of racing. And he gave me a chance. He said, I'm going to spend $20 million, which sounds like a lot of money. But
not for horses.
Mm-hmm. The other stables, the Arabs were spending billions.
Right.
And the other stables have been in for years and made up to billions. And, you know, plus the best jockeys and the best trainers and the best blah, right. blah, blah. And it was a closed works.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I said, fine, we'll do this. And by the third year, he was the leading owner in the United States, and whether after 6 years, he had the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years.
I love it.
And the day was American Pharoah.
American Pharoah, okay.
And then,
which makes sense. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then the day before the Belmont Stakes, which is going to be the Triple Crown, the New York Times had a front page center article about him and me and about this horse.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote of the day, they always have a quote of the day on the front page. The quote of the day was me. And it was, sell your house, don't sell this horse. Because he got in trouble in his business, and the Egyptian pound with an Arab Spring went down 50%. So he was really getting hit. So he was going to sell the horse at Saratoga, yearling. And he asked us our opinion, and we said, you know.
Keep the horse.
Sell your house. And he didn't. And we had bought the dam of the horse, by the way. You know, because it was the end of a long program of building these horses with these all these variables that were extraordinary, the mother and everything else. And this was an extraordinary horse. And so anyway, he did. And then he had problems in his other business, and he went bankrupt, and he disappeared. And some people blamed us, but I know we took his total about $40 million and we turned it into $64 million. And that was before American Pharoah. And I don't know how much American Pharoah was worth, but somewhere between $50 and $100
million. Right.
So at that point, we had a track record, you know, and our percentages. People still know. They're still using. The majority are still doing it the same old way.
Look.
Pedigree. And they do x-rays and shit, but they don't.
Detail.
They don't do sports medicine. They don't use modern technology. And they don't believe it either. And you have to say, what do I have to do? But anyway, we've done it. It's not a theory anymore. We published to begin with at our website, eqb.fyi, not .com, .fyi. You can download some of the papers with, you know, studies of 12,000 horses, real race horses at real racetracks, not ponies in a lab at a university.
Right.
On a treadmill. And, you know, over 10 years, you know, the study is designed by leading experts in all the field. And you can download it and look at it. And, you know, of course, there's a lot we haven't given away for free. But, you know, it's a real thing. And Ramsey's 90, and he's getting a new kidney. Zayat had all his other business problems. He's disappeared. So we're kind of between things, but we still do it. We bought, by the way, for Zayat, the average price we paid was below the auction averages. A lot of people.
So you were getting good deals in this.
The way we did it, we didn't buy the $1 million sale time. At the Kentucky Derby, by the way, this year, a $40,000 horse won.
Right.
Right behind him was the $2.3 million year. So we'd be in the 40. We've had champions we bought for $20,000 more than once. We've had our average price for Zayat was $155,000. Mm-hmm. Whereas most people will tell you all the best horses at the best auctions.
Right. It's got to be seven figures.
Mm-hmm. Well, seven figures are the 300, 400, 500, mm-hmm. 600. We didn't buy those. Mm-hmm. But the reason we didn't do it is because we knew statistically we could get the same odds of the champion with somebody else. Let them have that. Mm-hmm. We're going to get the same. And that way we could buy three or four of them. We didn't have to.
Right. Have a better chance.
Mm-hmm. Especially since, like I say, not all of them want to do it. Mm-hmm. And the injuries. There's a lot of injuries. Mm-hmm. And the better the horse, the faster they go, the faster they go. They're 1,000 pounds. Mm-hmm. They're going almost 45 miles an hour at full tilt. You know, there's many thousands of pounds of force on these tiny legs, the thin legs with the hoofs no bigger than
your hand. They're like little toothpicks.
And there's four, if they're lucky, we put fourth place in racetracks. If they're lucky, there's only 4 tons of force on that spindly leg.
Right.
If they do anything wrong, it can go up, multiply it's a mega mess. And, they get hurt.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, this whole world is just absolutely fascinating to me. You know, it's, I remember watching Big Red, right? Secretariat. When I was in elementary school, my best friend somehow decided she liked horse racing. And so we would gather at her house and we would watch, and we watched all three of the Triple Crowns and watch Secretariat win. And I still remember, and I still get chills when I see how far out he was. I mean, it was just incredible. And at that point I thought, wow, this is cool. And I had the opportunity to meet Penny Chinnery, who owned him, because I am from Colorado, and she spoke at a conference one time on for women business owners, because, you know, she was very unique and she still pretty much is. I mean, you know, unfortunately she has passed, but this is not a business that a lot of women get into, because it is a big business. I mean, you know, and
she took a lot of risks.
Oh, she did. You know, and it was just incredible to hear her stories. But, you know, I remember one of the things, and that was when they first really started talking about the heart, the size of the heart, was when they did the necropsy on Secretariat and discovered that internally that horse just had a heart that was twice the size of many other horses. You know, and just watching all of that and seeing it. But I think so many people don't even understand how big a business horse racing is around the world. But I mean, you know, here in the US, people think, okay, there's three races. Well, no. I mean, yeah, there are those three big races, but at, you know, even the days of those races. So like at the Derby, there's what, 30-ish races that day, or at least 20. And the Derby's only one of them. You know, and of course there are races all the time. I've been to Churchill Downs. I've never been fortunate enough to actually be there for any type of race. But you know, it is something that happens every weekend, you know, and which is why you talk about how much money this takes. I mean, you know, you've got to transport them, you've got to feed them, you've got all the people and the support staff that go along with it. And so, yeah, this is just not something where I could go, ooh, I think I want to do this.
Well, you could if you wanted to do it, but you know, then it's a lottery ticket,
right?
I mean, you can buy a horse $20,000 a year, $3,000-$4,000 a month to train it. And your chance, if you maybe you'll run at a minor racetrack, a minor races, you might have a hell of a good time. And maybe you'll get lucky. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be the first one.
Right.
But that's
I mean, we've all seen the movie Seabiscuit.
Right? But that's not the way to run it as a business. If you if it's going to be an alternative investment, and you have an expectation, you want to lower the risk.
Right. Then it's just like any type of investment.
Then you're buying you're buying a professional team. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to buy an NFL team or an NBA team, it's going to cost you billions of dollars.
Right.
Here, you know, and that's not $2 billion. It's maybe $20 million. But then that point, if you have people who really know what they're doing, like we do, and not, and believe me, there's a lot of guys out there who talk a good game, who are completely and utterly baloney. You know, we've had a lot of guys with cheap imitations of us who talk a mile a minute, and it's all nonsense. But anyway, if, you know, you have a real racing stable with people who know what they're doing, you can expect to have that fun and get back your money, and maybe you'll have a big, big return. And by the way, the three races, they know the Triple Crown races. Those are called Grade One races. But Grade One races are determined by an international body, a regulatory body. There's 100 of them, and there's 500 graded stakes. There's multi-million dollar races now all over the world.
Right.
There's multi-million dollar races in Maryland, mm-hmm. and New York, and California, mm-hmm. in Louisiana, mm-hmm. in Arkansas, mm-hmm. you know, in Florida. Mm-hmm. You know, there's if you're on the circuit, you got a lot of chances mm-hmm. at enormous purses, half right. a million and up. Mm-hmm. If you got a good horse, you don't have to mm-hmm. be on the grass or the dirt. You don't mm-hmm. have to be short. You don't have to be long. Mm-hmm. You can take your pick and go mm-hmm. for big money. Right. And the breeding value of the horses once mm-hmm. they win it, and it's much, mm-hmm. much bigger than you're going to win at the race.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you're not, you know, if you're going out of the business, you have to have a critical mass of horses mm-hmm. to make sure you get the right one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you have to have people managing it, mm-hmm. or you can just put, mm-hmm. it's possible. You know, you have to know when to quit and where mm-hmm. to go and who are the mm-hmm. rascals to stay away from.
Right. Because that happens with any type of business.
Well, it's more Damon Runyon and the racehorse. It's kind of wild and woolly, but that's part of what makes it mm-hmm. what it is. I mean, right. it's not a cubicle in a bank. Mm-hmm. It's not a CRT with an algorithm. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. hands-on and it's.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And,
you know, and it fascinated me this year when they were talking about the Preakness winner, Seize the Gray,
yeah.
where they said it was a consortium of owners.
600. I think yeah. someone put in like $500. And then they get a horse that wins the Preakness.
Yeah.
I don't know if they made any money or not.
But can you imagine for an everyday
yeah.
schmo like me to be able to say, I owned an interest in the horse that won the Preakness?
Yeah, that's a big deal. It's a once in a lifetime for most mm-hmm. people.
I wouldn't care if it paid off or not. I mean, just to be able to say my horse, you know, and yeah, I mean, there were, yeah, would you say 6,000 people?
600. But the purse was in the millions, you know?
Right. Oh, yeah.
And now it's obviously, a stallion, so it's going to have
room. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The stud fees are where the money is at because, yeah, it is a very limited lifespan that a horse.
And how about that Wayne Lucas? What is he, 90? 92?
I know. Oh, my gosh. And just still going strong. Well, and it's funny because in my other life, I'm very involved in the dog show world. And so, you know, I know a little bit about what you're talking about here, but just enough to be dangerous, right? But one of the people who was, and so Beagles, and one of the people who was very involved in Beagles, he has since passed, was Phil Baffert. And he was wow. Bob's uncle, you know, and actually Bob Baffert came to one of our shows one time and I got to meet him. This was long ago. But it is a very small world. I mean, aside from anything else, but it is, you know, I've been to Churchill Downs. I've been several times just to see it is so cool. And we did the tour where we got to go behind the scenes and it rained, of course. But I didn't care. I was going, I was perfectly fine with that. Unfortunately, it meant nobody was running because, you know, certainly safety is paramount for those horses and they weren't going to run them in the mud. But, you know, to me, I think this is what is so fascinating is now it is obviously, as you've been saying, very scientific with how they do it. And it is, you know, there
most of them don't do it scientifically.
No, they still do rare. The, hey, that looks like, and this,
we're
is,
still
you know, this is the pedigree. And,
of the people who claim they're scientific didn't do what we did.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's certainly not to the detail.
They don't have the quality of databases. They don't have the equipment, the mm-hmm, technicians. Mm-hmm. They don't know.
Right.
They just.
But it is something where the everyday schmoes like me or, you know, can put money into it. Now, clearly, you know, it is something still for
people
who have money.
Well, the partnerships will do that. Mm-hmm. If you can look up partnerships mm-hmm. and that way you can learn about the game
right.
and have some mm-hmm. fun and not spend a lot in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's a good idea.
Well, and you should do that with any type of investment that you're doing, right? You shouldn't just say, I'm going to buy this type of stock because it sounds good. No,
yeah, due diligence is a big deal.
Yeah. You know, you need
especially in horse racing.
Oh, yeah. You know, and it's funny because I have a friend, he passed away, but he owned, his family owned property in Kentucky. And as they put it, and you know, we knew he was right on this. It was the property next to where Secretariat was, he would talk about the fact that it is a minute number of horses, just like with an elite athlete, that actually are that successful.
Yeah, you're going after one one half or 1%.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
you
I
know,
tell
not everybody's
by the way, we're
Jordan
doing DNA now.
Mm-hmm.
Another way we can get, of course, it's less expensively. Mm-hmm. We're buying them much younger now. We're buying them when they're babies.
Right.
We've got DNA databases we've built up over the last 20 years. And I tell people, I say, you know, I publish some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to teach people. Occasionally we hire somebody and they leave and take as much as they can take.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I say I can give them the violin and the instruction manual, but they're not going to play a symphony right away.
Right. Oh, yeah. You know, they're not, even if you give them a Stradivarius, you know, they're going to go, right?
Pretty much to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's different about us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Secretariat, you know, he was different. He's different at DNA, different at his heart. He was different.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we've taken that apart and seen a lot of it. But yeah,
right.
And I don't know, what else can I tell you about it?
Well, you know, and I think what is so fascinating about this is you're doing all of this for basically 2 minutes, right? If even that much.
You know? Yeah, it's true.
Like they say, the fastest minute in
greatest 2 minutes in sports. When they were I think it was the Belmont this year. They had a stand for one of the bourbons they were selling, and they were giving out shot glasses of bourbon, and they were saying the greatest 2 ounces in sports.
I love it. I love it. Well, and of course, this year with the Preakness, where you didn't know who the winner was,
that was
fascinating to be able to see that. And but I can't imagine being the people who were thinking, "Is it us? Is it us? Is it us?" You know, and of course the TV cameras were trying to catch all of that and all of that. But it is, you know, it is one of those things that is truly a passion for people who decide to do this. It's, you know, yeah
that's
you've got
the thing
people
you
got
to understand.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new series on Netflix called Wildfire, and they get a lot of the stuff about the training wrong, but they get it right about the horses. And this movie about Secretariat, they got it right. That the people who do this, they do it because it's a passion.
Right.
It's a lifestyle. It's and they're getting something out of it. They're in love with their horses. You know, if they're not in the beginning, then it grows on. It'll grow. And the baby horses in the spring. And
well, like
and
you said, just being on the farm. Oh, my gosh. It's just glorious. I love driving through horse country.
That's why I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I still do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And but I managed to figure out a way to get a living out of it.
Mm-hmm. So. I love it. You know, and as we said, it is something that it is, you know, it is a huge business. You know, I billions and billions of dollars, especially if you're figuring worldwide. But you know, it's and we as the lay people get
no
to see so very little of it. And because We just see, you know, the little bit before the big races, you know, and it was so funny because I remember this year when I was getting ready to watch the Derby, you know, it said it came on at 2:00 and I'm thinking, nah, the Derby's not at 2:00. And so actually trying to figure out what time was the Derby itself going to be run was kind of the challenge. But it's, you know, I told you before the show, the friend who got us into watching, you know, back when we were elementary kids, she went to the Derby this year. And it was truly one of those bucket list type of things. And she and her friends did it big. They bought the suite. I didn't even ask how much she spent. I didn't want to know. And, you know, even just things like the hotel room was $700. I mean,
yeah, you can go 20 miles away and get a cheaper hotel room. But then on the other hand, at the airport there in Kentucky, the Kentucky Derby, they have a field next to the airport. And they have a parking lot for the private jets. So there's like 100 private jets in parking spaces next to the airport.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, and it's the celebrities, it's the owners, it's all of those, you know, and it really, you know, and you know, I have yet to see.
And the whole week is nonstop parties at the restaurants downtown.
I mean, that was the thing, too, was seeing the pictures that she was posting. Because, yeah, it's not just that minute. You know, it is everything that leads up to it and everything. And I forget what time she said they actually left Churchill Downs, but it was, you know, the wee small hours of the morning. And they, you know, they were very sensible. They hired a driver, you know, because that was part of it. You know, if you're there, you're going to have mint juleps, you know, and all of those, but to me, it would also be, and I have to, you know, I don't even care if I see the Derby. I need to go see horse racing. Now, I'm always really scared that those little toothpick legs, something's going to happen. But just
getting better. You know, the feds took it over now. Mm-hmm. The regulatory body is now federal.
Right.
And they've been at it a little, I don't know, a year or 2 years. And they're making a difference. This year, the number of catastrophic accidents and deaths went down 38%.
Wow.
Since they started, they've only been at it about a year and a half or so. So they're tightening up on the drugs and on everything on the lameness and the racetrack inspections.
Right.
They've already got it down by more than a third. So that's good stuff. Mm-hmm. Good stuff coming. And that's just the beginning. Mm-hmm. And Churchill Downs, by the way, they've gotten better. And the way they manage the Derby, you know, it's not just like a football stadium. Mm-hmm. They take care of those people.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, I just want to go.
There's a million places to buy stuff, places to eat, drinks, tables, places to look from, stuff going on. And you never feel like you're just one of 4 billion people being pushed around, although it is body to body with 160,000 people.
Right.
They do a really good job of making it good. The whole city does. Mm-hmm. They just do a good job.
Right. You know, and it's funny. I'm not a crowd fan. So I'm thinking I would actually like to go to a non-Derby race because I'd probably enjoy it more.
We'll go to the paddock and get up right next to the horse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like I said, we took the tour one time where we got to do that. And it was just and the nice thing was, I mean, there were like five of us on the tour. And because it was raining, they just pretty much let us do whatever we wanted. I mean, clearly there were rules. We weren't, you know, that we weren't allowed to just mill about wherever we wanted. Safety was paramount for us also. It was so cool just to see that. And I've always been a horse fan. And the really funny thing, I don't ride. I've been on a horse twice in my life and didn't really enjoy it. I like to watch it.
It's a lot more fun when you don't have to worry about pulling off.
Which is what I've done, right? I love the big horses. You know, I had friends who had the big draft horses. And, you know, you show me the Clydesdales and I'm just all a Twitter. It's just when I see those horses, doesn't matter
Are you based?
So I'm actually in Atlanta, but I am from Colorado way up in the mountains. And we had friends who had the big draft horses and still did haying using the big draft horses.
I'm in Amish country right next to me.
Yep.
They plow. Yeah. Oh, everything's horses. Mm-hmm. And even the buggies at the Walmarts.
Yeah.
The Walmart parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
There's a big shed where they can park the buggies where the horses get shade.
Oh, yeah, because you need shade and water and a little bit of grain maybe in there for
them. That's where we are.
Yeah.
And water.
Yeah, I mean, I would prefer that to pro sports. I'm a pro sport fan, but yeah, I mean, to see those horses, and I've been to Budweiser, but I've seen the Clydesdales up close and all of those things. They're just such magnificent beasts, and I think that's part of this whole appeal is when you look at whatever type of horse it is, even if it's just, you know, somebody's I'm going to ride on Sunday type of horse, they're just a magnificent animal.
And they have a mind. I mean, they have a person.
Oh, yeah.
And they remember people and they like certain people.
Oh, yeah.
You can, in fact, have a relationship with them that's real, not baloney.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's if you're all the horse people are dog people. They all have dogs. Mm-hmm. They're all animal people.
And they've got a goat because the goat needs to be with the horses.
They have geese. They love animals and cats, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you're an animal person, if you're a dog lover, you know, you'll get horses. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised.
Right. Well, and, you know, I mentioned the National Beagle Club. I have been privileged to be able to go to their headquarters in Aldi, Virginia. I actually sit on the board. And so I've been able to go when they're out doing pack trials. And so to see the dogs do what the dogs were actually supposed to be doing. But they always, you know, the judges are on horseback also. I mean, you know, and so to be able to see that. Now, I've never, you know, it's just so cool to me to see the animals do what nature intended for the animals to do.
Fellow travelers on our planet with us in their own journeys.
Yep. You know, but when you think about really, as you were saying, everything that goes into making that one in a million that sees the gray, that, you know, all of those. And, you know, it was disappointing when we didn't have, you know, have a triple crown winner, but it's also fun to see the other horses win too.
Yeah, it is. I mean, a low level, if it's your horse, a low level race can be exhilarating.
Oh, yeah.
When you go to the track, put $2 on one of them and you'll be surprised how much more exciting the race is.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and sometimes $2 will win you quite a bit.
It doesn't have to be a champion for it to be. I mean, that's part of the thing. Part of the secret. You don't have to have a champion for it to be worth your while. It's a lifestyle and it's a sport and even making money. I mean, we have what I call our average horses, and they are $200,000-$300,000. And they bought them for maybe $50,000, and they spent maybe $50,000. So they actually made a profit. They never won a major race.
Right.
Didn't cost them a dime, and they had all that for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, they get to see it. I mean, you know, that just, oh my gosh, you know, those. And I think people who've never been around it don't realize how big those horses are, you know, and I'm talking about the thoroughbreds, you know, obviously the Clydesdales and horses like that.
No, they're dangerous. They can kick you. They can kill you.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Shot. You know, I've known from when I was a wee little girl, you don't walk behind a horse.
1,000 pounds and they're strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very strong. How do you think they pull the plow or the wagons or the stagecoaches, you know?
Yep. Yeah, you know, and to see that, I mean, it's just incredible. And so yeah, I envy you that you are in that and you get to, like you said, you know, that's where you are. I mean, that
was started as a city boy and I had to bail to get to it. I knew the first time I had a horse, I got riding, then I bought a horse and then I ran a stable and then I rented a farm. When I rented my first farm, I moved my horse to the farm. And I went out and he was in the stall, I had William's stall. And then I stood there in front of him. His name was Tony. And I said, Tony, we're living together. And it was just a big deal. It was a big deal.
And so cool.
And I loved that horse. And we used to go out and joke the most ridiculous stuff. It was too dangerous, but I did it because I was young and stupid.
Yeah. But you had a bond with Tony. And Tony knew that you were going to take care of him and he was going to take care of you.
Pretty much. It actually sounds like baloney, but it's so true. It is.
Yeah. Which, you know, back to horse racing. I mean, that's why you see the jockeys that really develop that bond with those horses. It's not just you're going to throw
some of the greatest jockeys of all time. Everybody knew they were like horse whisperers. They got they had a bond with those horses. Steve Coughlin was one like that. Well, he would, nobody could be with a horse like he was.
Right.
And my horse, you know, you said take care of me. They do. Like, you know, if you fall off or do something stupid, they didn't run away. They came back.
Right. They come back. Right. Are you okay?
Yeah. They did.
Right.
I mean, maybe if you run a horse in a stable or something, a dude ranch, they're going to run off.
But they're going to go where it's safe. They're like,
going to go where it's food.
Lost, but if lost it's your the horse idiot and
they
know there.
You, they're going to come back and check on it. So,
yeah. You know, and, you know, it's funny. I mentioned the movie Seabiscuit. You know, that was one where I think we really saw the relationship between the horse and the jockey.
They saved each other, the whole, all of them, the whole bunch of them, from tragedies, all their personal tragedies, from death of the son, to the complete dysfunctional life of that poor jockey.
Right.
And to the horse that was going to be, they were going to shoot him when they decided to save the cost of the bullet. They all came together for each other.
Right.
And it's hokey, but it's real. It happened.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't, if you're a part of it, you don't laugh at all.
No, no. You know, because, it is a business, but like I said, it is a passion.
And in essence, most of the guys in it, you know, they have years they lose their ass and years they make some money, but that's not what it's about. That's not what it's about. I mean, I watch this thing on Netflix now, Wildfires Come Back, the TV series from 50 years ago. And they get, I told you, they get the training all right, but I'm bringing it up again because they get so right about the life of it, why they do it, and how they, who they are, and the horse and the rider.
I love it. Well, oh my gosh, Jeff, this has been so much fun, and we've only got about 5 minutes left. So if somebody is saying, I need to know more, I really want to know more, how do they reach out and connect with you?
Okay, the easiest quick way, it's our website.
Okay.
It's not a .com. .com is a Canadian bank.
I discovered that.
Mm-hmm. We're EQB.FYI. Okay. .FYI, not .com. Mm-hmm. EQB, like Equine Biometrics. Mm-hmm. And on that site, it's enormous amount of information. Mm-hmm. They tell me there's too much and it's not modern enough. But you can get everything from mm-hmm. downloading mm-hmm. Copies of enormous database and mm-hmm. scientific papers to a 5-minute video that primer on what to look at in slow motion and mm-hmm. a horse's gait mm-hmm. to a list of every horse we bought that did and mm-hmm. what we paid for it and what it did mm-hmm. and a whole lot of other stuff about me and my partner, Patty mm-hmm. Miller. By the way, the turning point in my business is when I got my partner, Patty Miller. Mm-hmm. She's one of the first women jockeys. She was from 2 years old on, she was riding horses mm-hmm. in a basket on the back of her mother's hunter. grandmother's hunter. Mm-hmm. She set track records as a trainer. And when she came, I broke my arm and I couldn't break my own yearling, and I hired her to come mm-hmm. break the, and that's how I met her. And we have been like this, we bang heads, but mm-hmm. I say, I look at the altimeter and she looks out the window to see if they're off the ground. Mm-hmm. She brought to me, you know, a lifetime of horsemanship and the right. great trainer, Billy Turner. She had that heart.
Mm-hmm.
She had the 300 years of traditional horsemanship. Mm-hmm. relationships and knowledge and so instead of being the pointy-headed asshole that was putting high tech on top of bad basics, she gave us the foundation. Mm-hmm. And once we started to put our high tech mm-hmm. on top of the top-notch right. basics, mm-hmm. that's when it really started mm-hmm. to bloom. Mm-hmm. And she's still there doing that for us. So without Patty Miller, we're mm-hmm. nowhere.
I love it.
So it's really a team effort. Mm-hmm. And her story and my story are on that website, EQB.FYI. Mm-hmm. And then the other way is, you know, give us a call, come visit. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I just did, somebody saw me on a website, some webcast somewhere, and he asked me about it. And so I said, you know what, you want to do due diligence? I sent him like 20 ways to do due diligence, mm-hmm. free places on the internet. You can mm-hmm. look up all the facts about a trainer, mm-hmm. an owner, a horse, mm-hmm. About technology, about, you know, I said, here it is. It's all these data, all these information mm-hmm. sources, do your own to help you do the due diligence. I didn't just give him a big, mm-hmm. come on, pitch. I know that if he goes there and he does that, he's going to end up with us.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah, because you're so... Because
we're the real thing and we can prove
it. And you are mentoring them.
Yeah, and that's the other thing we do. We don't say, good, we'll do it. Just leave us alone. A lot of mm-hmm. trainers say, I'm the big guy. Don't mm-hmm. tell me how to do it. Mm-hmm. We're the opposite. Mm-hmm. We say, come join us. Every inch of the way, we'll mm-hmm. tell you what we're doing, why we're doing it. You come, but do it with us. Mm-hmm. And that, because that's the journey's a big part. Right. If they want to do that, mm-hmm. you know, come and do it with mm-hmm. us. We'll do it for you. Mm-hmm.
I love it so much. Well, oh my gosh, this really has been so much fun talking about this. It put me back to thinking really about when I saw Secretariat win. I mean, you know, and all of the races and everything in between. I mean, it's just so fascinating to see.
The Secretariat was something. He set in that race in the Belmont, he set the world record for mm-hmm. a mile. Mm-hmm. And who was it? Sham, who was right next to him. He mm-hmm. was cooked. Mm-hmm. And Secretariat wasn't cooked, and he kept going another right. half mile and set that world record.
Yeah, yeah, they couldn't stop him. Yep.
And now it's what, 30, 40 years later, nobody's done.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, anybody, today, folks, go and look it up on YouTube, and just see, because I think what impressed me about it was the easiness of it. I mean, you know, it just was like, I'm going
to
do this.
To me, but mm-hmm. it wasn't the easiness; it was. That
right.
this was a horse who mm-hmm. loves.
Oh yeah, Secretariat loved doing it. I mean, that
he
was
he was not beating on that horse to get that world record.
No, yeah, I mean, there was no, you know, I'm sure he had a whip, but that he did not
he didn't
use
need it.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it was just incredible. Well, oh my gosh, Jeff, this really has been so much fun. Do you have any final thoughts that you want to leave everyone with?
Any final thoughts? Let's see. Yeah, it's more fun than being in the bank cubicle. Where I started.
I love it.
And I think it's a legitimate, if you just want to do it for fun, there's a way to do that. But if you want to own a professional sports team without paying $1 billion, this is a way you can do it for a tiny fraction of that. So those are my final thoughts.
So much fun. Well, I am Deb Creer. I've been having so much fun talking with Jeff Seder. And until next time, everyone have a great day.
Tune in for our next program for even more trends, best practices, and techniques for how to make your business a success. The Business Power Hour, hosted by Deb Creer, is proud to be part of the C-Suite Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.